So Ephesians chapter 5, and 2 weeks ago when we were talked about the first part here, about we talked about wives, talked about how they were some successful women in the scriptures that were successful because of submissiveness, not because of exerting their authority or because of some great manly act, if you will, that they did. It was because of their submissiveness. It was because of their character, and their commitment to what was right, and we talked about how that was. If we're comparing it, you know, looking at how this is in the big picture that Paul is talking about here is Christ and the church, but he uses the church. Or the church is an example of what the wife ought to be. You know, how is the church subject to Christ? Is the church exerting authority over Christ? Is the church instructing Christ what to do? And now we're going to talk about some things today on the husband, but we were talking about the wife and how like the role of the wife isn't to fulfill a spot that the husband's lacking, and the role of the wife is to fulfill her spot. What she's supposed to be doing, her work, and so the same would be true for the husband today. As we start in verse 25, someone want to go ahead and read that, please.
Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her.
Okay, so as the church is a picture of, you know, and how the church goes is how the wife is supposed to be in relation to her husband. Christ is the example for the husband on how the husband is to be to his wife. And so a question we can have is, you know, what does that look like? What are some of the details in that? You know, it's easy to say, well, just as Christ loved the church, the husband ought to love the wife. And what does this look like? Let's turn over to Colossians 3. To start with here, Colossians 3, someone read verse 19.
Husbands, love your wives, and do not be embittered against them.
Okay, so similar to what Ephesians says, except for it adds something here. The word embittered there is only used four times in the New Testament, obviously here. The other three times it's used in the revelation of Jesus Christ, and two of them are used in chapter 10. Let's turn over to chapter 10 just to get an idea for a second here. So don't be embittered against the wife, your wife. And so part of loving them goes hand in hand with not being embittered against them. And in chapter 10 of Revelation of Jesus Christ, it talks about at the beginning there's this angel that it has, which this is a picture of Jesus here, this angel that has this red book in its hand, in his hand. And this little red book here, the little book, I guess, I don't know if it says it's red, but the little book in his hand, he speaks in verse 8, he is told, actually we'll have someone read that, 8 through 10 before we make the point here. Revelation 10, 8 through 10, please.
And the voice which I heard from heaven, I heard again speaking with me, saying, go take the book which is open in the hand of the angel who stands at the sea and on the land. And I went to the angel, telling him to give me the little book. And he said to me, take it, eat it, and it will make your stomach bitter. But in your mouth it will be sweet as honey. I took the little book out of the angel's hand and ate it. And it was in my mouth sweet as honey. When I had eaten it, my stomach was made bitter.
Okay, so the angel here is Jesus. The book what he has is the gospel. Okay, Now, we can go on to talking about like some of the details here. I'm just giving you the 10,000-foot view here of what this is talking about. Another angel says, go and take the book in the hand of the angel and take it and eat it, and it'll make your stomach be bitter, but your mouth will be sweet as honey. So as the gospel, when it is eaten and it's referred to, the word of God is referred to as bread a lot of times. You know, it's something that not necessarily, it's not physical bread, obviously, but it's referred to as nourishment. And if you look at the gospel, it is as sweet as honey, but what follows obedience to Christ is the bitterness of persecution. Okay, so it was something that was sweet. It is something that is nourishing, but there's bitterness of persecution that follows obedience to Christ and being subject to the King. Now that word for bitter in both 9 and 10 is the same word that's translated, don't be embittered against your wife, in Colossians chapter 3, verse 19. Now, if you look at that, for example, there, what Paul is using, he's using a word, and you can kind of compare it. The question we can ask ourselves as husbands is that do we treat our wives like the world persecutes the church? Because that's that same word that goes along with that. That's that same word that Paul uses there, is that word bitter that John, as he took the book and ate it, and it's sweet as honey, but it was bitter in his stomach. It's the same as, hey, don't be embittered against your wives. That persecution that follows those who obey the gospel shouldn't be something that the husband is treating his wife or using against his wife. Don't be embittered against your wife. Let's turn over to 1 Peter chapter 3. First Peter chapter 3. Now, we read the first part of this chapter last time, and we even went back into chapter 2, and we talked about, and let's just do that to start with here again. So I want to read 21 through 25 of 1 Peter chapter 2. We'll do that first.
For you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps. He committed no sins, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And he himself bore our sins in his body on the cross, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by his wounds you were healed. For you were continually straying like sheep, but now you have returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls.
Okay, so one thing I think that is important, so we have the example of Christ here, how in specifically in verse 23, it talks about him not having any sin and no deceit found in his mouth in verse 22, but he was reviled, he didn't revile in return, but he kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. Continuing on in the same way, in chapter 3 of verse 1, it says, in the same way, wives, be submissive to your husbands. And we talked about that last time. But if we go down to verse 7, someone read verse 7 of 1 Peter chapter 3.
You husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way as with someone weaker, since she is a woman, and show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers will not be hindered.
Okay, so thinking about this second here, so if what Christ's example applied, you know, applies to all of us in general anyway, but it's applying here, and Peter's using that, and then he, in the same way, wives, be submissive to your husbands. But then he goes down in verse 7, husbands likewise. So he's saying in the same way, just like Christ was, again, a spouse is saying mean things to the husband. If in following Christ's example, the husband isn't to return and revile. He's supposed to keep entrusting himself to him who judges righteously, just as Christ did when he was getting persecuted. And the same thing, obviously, we mentioned last time about the wives would be the same way. But the husbands here, it doesn't give us the right to revile in return. In the same way, live with your wives as a weaker, in an understanding way, as a weaker vessel, since she is a woman. Okay, and so live with them in an understanding way. Don't revile in return. Keep entrusting ourselves to Him who judges righteously, even though we might not be being treated right. Okay, it doesn't give us the right to do that. And so another thing in verse 7 here, grant her fellow honor. And that Greek word for honor, that means a valuing or a price. Okay, so we are to consider her valuable, and she is worth a lot to her husband. You know, if we don't, in that context, then if we're looking at this as a context of how to act when we're getting treated poorly, whether husband or wife, but especially specifically as a husband today, when we value, if we lose the value of the spouse, if our wife's value diminishes and gets less and less and less, then it says there, but it says not to let that happen so your prayers may not be hindered. And so if you think about that, that's not talking about one fight. That's talking about if she is a lesser value, and what that comes from, that comes from not caring, or I should say, not spending time in care or in spousal care. I guess you should say, I could say, not making a point to have spouse care in the way is if we're not putting the marriage as husbands, if we're not being leaders in that, then pretty soon, then you got pride coming, then you have jealousy coming, then you have bitterness coming. Okay, that's what Peter is talking about here. Of, you know, if we don't consider the wife valuable, no matter what, that's leading. If that's just the beginning of pride, and that's the beginning of bitterness, that's the beginning of jealousy, and that's the beginning of selfishness, which therefore hinders the prayers. It's not that, like, oh, you have a fight, then God doesn't hear that prayer that day until you make up with your spouse. It's that there is that pride and that bitterness and that jealousy that's building because of the care that we as husbands should be the leaders of. And then the wife obviously has a part in that too. But we as husbands should be the leader, and we should live with the wives in an understanding way, understand that they're a weaker vessel, and honoring them and valuing them so that pride doesn't come, the jealousy doesn't come, the bitterness doesn't come, selfishness doesn't come. That falls on us there to be leaders for that, so that the prayers aren't hindered. Because when you have those problems, that's when the prayers are hindered. Because if that's the closest relationship that we have outside of Christ in us. And so if there's pride and there's jealousy in that, then that is going to affect the prayers. I mean, it's not just talking about one fight. It's talking about a lot of things that we aren't doing as husbands to allow that to get to that spot. And that falls that's our responsibility there. That's our responsibility as husbands to do that. And again, obviously, you know, this is as the wives being submissive that we talked last time, the husband, it takes the husband to have a good marriage too in that way, but it also in the same way that it takes the wife here to work with the husband as well. And that's why there's no chapters and verses and separations when Peter is talking here. Okay? But the husband is supposed to be the leader in that, and we'll see a few more, maybe another example here, a couple of examples here to talk about that, because Christ was the leader, you know, last week in Quick Draw, Brandon's verse was in 1 John 4, where Christ, you know, he loved us, you know, the love of God, and I can't remember exactly the quote, but if we don't love, we're not a part of God, because God is love. And you can couple that with Romans 5, where while we were still sinners, Christ died for us, and Christ, even though we didn't deserve it, Christ died for us. So as husbands, if we're following the example of Christ, then if we are to bring the wife in that way and help her in that way, it doesn't matter whether she's deserving of that or not. That falls on us to be leaders in that. Okay, let's turn back to Ruth chapter 2. Ruth chapter 2. So we looked at Ruth last time, and we talked about how, what Ruth did to be successful, and she was successful because she was submissive. We're going to start in Ruth chapter 2, and so I want to read 5 through 12.
Let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. Thus she came and has remained from the morning until now. She has been sitting in the house for a little while. How far? 10, 9?
12, please.
12. Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go off in this one, but stay here with my maids. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. When you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants draw." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" Boaz replied to her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother in the land of your birth and came to a people that you did not previously know. May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge."
Okay, so notice Boaz here, the kindness that he was showing here to Ruth. Okay, now they weren't married yet, but you see that how he was kind to her, and he does mention that because of how she was and her character, how she had left her father's house and stayed with her mother-in-law after her husband died and so on. And she came to this people that she didn't know. But he says, maybe the Lord reward you for your work. Okay, let's turn ahead a little to chapter 3. And so I want to read 10 through 13.
And he said, "May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether rich or whether poor or rich. Now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask for. All my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence. And now it is true I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. Remain this night, and when morning comes, if he will redeem you, good, let him redeem you. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you as the Lord lives. Lie down until morning."
Okay, so we see here that Boaz, the custom, as we talked last time, that Boaz had the Jew, when the brother or the husband died, then the brother, the next brother would marry his wife and bear children or raise up children to his name. But in the case here, where both of Naomi's sons had died. Boaz was a relative, but he said that there is a relative that was closer. And so he's showing the kindness, even though, you know, it wasn't just like it was the easiest thing, because it didn't just mean having a spouse, but he had a care for her, okay? And so it wasn't like it was just something that was real easy for Boaz to do, but his character of how he was wanting to do that for Ruth, but he knew that there was obviously someone else that was close relative, and if he wasn't going to redeem her, then he would, okay? That's what he was saying. So look at the character there that he is really would sacrifice for a potential spouse, and obviously she became a spouse. And so you could say here, well, that was really easy because look at how the character of Ruth was because of what she was doing. The character that she has of being with her mother-in-law, even though she didn't have to be, because the other sister-in-law left back in chapter 1 there. And even when she came in and was good to Boaz in chapter 3 here, well, that was pretty easy for Boaz to make that sacrifice, okay? But the point in making this is that Boaz still made the sacrifice, and you think that the character there as a husband has to be that how can I help my spouse? How can I help my wife? It's not about what it is for me. It's about how can I help her. Let's look at another example. Let's turn to Hosea. Maybe not so easy of a wife here. Hosea chapter 1. Gomer wasn't quite a daughter of Ruth in that she was followed after her character. A little bit of reading here. Someone want to start off and read Hosea 1, chapter 1, 1 through 11.
1 through 11.
Yes, please.
The word of the Lord came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, during the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. When the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, "Go, take to yourself a wife of harlotry and have children of harlotry, for the land commits flagrant harlotry, forsaking the Lord." So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And the Lord said to him, "Name him Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will punish the house of Jehu for the bloodshed of Jezreel, and I will put an end the kingdom of the house of Israel. On that day, I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel." Then she conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. And the Lord said to him, "Name her Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel, that I would ever forgive them, but I will have compassion on the house of Judah and deliver them by the Lord their God, and will not deliver them by bow, sword, battle, horses, or horsemen." When she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she received and gave birth to a son. And the Lord said, "Name him Lo-Ami, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. Yet the number of the sons of Israel will be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. Where it is said to them, 'You are not my people,' it will be said to them, 'You are the sons of the living God.' And the sons of Judah and the sons of Israel will be gathered together, and they will appoint for themselves one leader, and they will go up from the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel."
Okay, now, so we're looking at, Hosea, start with, and we'll keep reading here, but Hosea, was going to take a wife of harlotry, and he was going to be shown how Israel was to God, her husband, and how it was like, and what it was like to have that, and he was going to be an example. And as we're going to see here, that Hosea is actually a type of Christ. We'll get to there in a second. But let's go ahead and keep going here in chapter 2, 1 through 13, and then someone else want to read the rest, 14 through 23 after that.
"Say to your brother Ami and to your sister contend with her mother, contend, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband. Let her put away her harlotry from her face, and her adultery from between her breasts. For I will strip her naked and expose her as on the day when she was born. I will also make her like a wilderness, make her like desert land, and slay her with thirst. Also, I will have no compassion on her children, because they are children of harlotry. For the mother has played the harlot, she who conceived them has acted shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers, who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. Therefore, behold, I will hedge up her way with thorns, and I will build a wall against her so that she cannot find her path. She will pursue her lovers, but she will not overtake them. And she will seek them, but will not find them. Then she will say, I will go back to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now. For she does not know what it was I who gave her the grain, the new wine, and the oil, and lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for bail. Therefore I will take back my grain at harvest time and my new wine in its season. I will also take away my wool and my flax given to cover her nakedness. And then I will uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and no one will rescue her out of my hand. I will also put an end to all her gaiety, her feasts and her moons, her Sabbaths, and all her festal assemblies. I will destroy her vines and fig trees, of which she said, these are my wages which my lovers have given me, and I will make them a forest, and the breast of the field will devour them. I will punish her for the days of the Baals when she used to offer sacrifices to them and adorn herself with her earrings and jewelry, and follow her lovers, so that she forgot me, declares the Lord.
So on, read 14 through 23, please.
Therefore, behold, I will allure her, bring her into the wilderness, and speak kindly to her, and I will give her vineyards from there, in the valley of Achor, as a door of hope. And she will sing there as in the days of her youth, as in the day when she came up from the land of Egypt. It will come about in that day, declares the Lord, that you will call me Ishai and will no longer call me Baali. For I will remove the names of the Baals from your mouth, so that they will be mentioned by their names no more. In that day I will also make a covenant for them with the beasts of the sky and the creeping things of the ground. And I will abolish the bow, the sword, and war from the land. I will make them lie down in safety. I will betroth you to me forever. Yes, I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice, in loving kindness and in compassion. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness. Then you will know the Lord. It will come about in that day that I will respond, declares the Lord. I will respond to the heavens, and they will respond to the earth. And the earth will respond to the grain and the new wine and to the oil. And they will respond to Jezreel. I will sow her for myself in the land. I will also have compassion on her who had not obtained compassion. And I will say to those who are not my people, you are my people. And they will say, you are my God.
Okay. So we're looking here this is twofold here. It's talking about the unfaithfulness of Israel, but it's talking about the unfaithfulness of Gomer as well. Okay, and how she was unfaithful, how she pursued other men. But really, in verse 7, she'll pursue her lovers, but she will not overtake them. She will seek them, but will not find them. And then she returns to her husband. So she's really, they've used her and they've left her. They didn't really love her. They used her and they left her. But we see here, and the unfaithfulness of her. Now we see in chapter 3, let's look at Hosea's response to how, you know, you could say that this wasn't just a real quick deal that happened. It was happened over a period of time. Jezreel probably was legitimate, was Hosea's, But the other two probably were not. Okay, and that's kind of the what he's talking there when he says that is so she conceived from with someone else. Okay, and so if you think of that there, you think of what of how bad she was to him. Let's look at her his response in chapter 3. Chapter 3, 1 through 3. Okay, so Hosea goes and buys her. We'll use the word redeems her, or I'll even use the phrase buys her for a price. Okay, those are some familiar phrases that we've heard before. So he bought her, and now let's look at in verse chapter 4, verse 1. Someone read that, please.
Listen to the word of the Lord, O sons of Israel. Has a case against the inhabitants of the land because there is no faithfulness or kindness or knowledge of God in the land.
Okay, so looking at all this here, I know there's quite a bit of reading we did there, but so Hosea, if we're comparing the harlot to both Israel and Gomer, okay, so Hosea goes and he buys her for a price. He redeems her to be his, to back to him again. But if we look at the in chapter 4, when it says the Lord has a case against the inhabitants of the land, let's interchange that with Hosea and Gomer. Hosea had a case for divorce, if you would say. He had a case to say, hey, she can just have what she had and sleep in the bed that she's made. Why do I need to go buy her? Because her lovers now aren't going to have her now anyway either. And she pursues them, but she won't find them. She's down at the bottom of the barrel. She's a slave now. And so he goes and buys her. He could have just left. He could have had a case to say, well, she's been unfaithful to me, so why not just let her be there? But he goes and he purchases her for a price, and he buys her. Hosea had a case, but he didn't. Just a side note, it's not quite making the point here, but a side note, it shows a little bit like you know, it was pretty easy for Boaz to go do what he did for Ruth and redeem Ruth, but it wasn't, probably wouldn't be quite as easy for Hosea. And it seems like there's maybe quite a few excuses that could be thrown out the window in divorces today if you're looking at it compared to how Hosea was with Gomer. And if you look at how he reacts as a husband, now one thing I want to make sure, it kind of leaves it here and we don't have a lot any much more said about specifically Hosea and Gomer here, but if we're comparing the harlot to be both Hosea, both Gomer and Israel, and Hosea being like God to Gomer and God being obviously the husband to Israel, okay, then when we come back on the other side, when God redeems Israel, as we'll see in a second here, it doesn't just have, like, Hosea and Gomer aren't just sitting here having this miserable marriage because they have to be married now because they got married and not having a miserable marriage the rest of their life. See, Hosea did this for a purpose to help Gomer because he was the husband, because he was the man, because he's the stronger vessel, because he's a leader, to help her be who she could be, even though she went astray. Let's go turn to Hosea chapter 14, last chapter here. Hosea 14, And let's look at verse 1 and 2 of Hosea 14, please. Okay, so that last phrase there in verse 2, that's pretty familiar. The Israel that God is talking here, that Hosea is writing about, that God is they're returning to the Lord, that the Lord may receive them graciously, that we may present the fruit of our lips. Let's turn ahead to Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews 13. Someone read verse 15, please.
Through him, then, let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God. That is
okay, so the writer of Hebrews here is writing about the church here, and he is saying that the church offers continually a sacrifice of praise to God, that is the fruit of lips that give thanks to his name. If Hosea is talking about the fruit of lips back in Hosea 14, The Israel that God is redeeming, he's redeeming them and they're receiving them graciously, that they may present the fruit of the lips. That's showing that what the Israel that he's redeeming is not the physical Israel for one, but it was those who are of the true heart, those who wanted to be obedient to God. Okay, and so that's talking about the church. So if you're comparing Hosea and Gomer to God and Israel, and God desiring to have Israel return to him, and it's not the physical nation, but it's those who have the true character, the spiritual nation, Hosea and his marriage to Gomer, it wasn't just that they had this miserable bound marriage that they just had to have because they were married. Is that he is redeeming her in order to help her to the glory, we'll use that word, to present her in all her glory, blameless and without wrinkle. Okay, it's because what God is doing there, if that's comparable, God is doing that for Israel. What he is doing there is he is redeeming Israel. Let's just turn back to Ephesians 5 then. Ephesians chapter 5. And let's read in verse 26 through 29. Someone read that, please. Okay, so if we're looking in the context of what Paul's writing there, the husbands love your wives as Christ loved the church. So if the redeeming of Israel was that they could offer the fruit of lips, was that God redeemed them and God offered this sanctified this bride, Jesus sanctified, he cleansed her, that he might present the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but she should be holy and blameless. That comparison of Hosea there, when he is buying her with a price, when he's buying Gomer with a price, is that he is buying her, it's not so that he can just, because he has to be married to her, he is buying her so that he can help her be who she was supposed to be. He can help her in all her glory. That's the responsibility of the husband. The responsibility of the husband is that he can sanctify her, he can cleanse her, that he can present her in all her glory without wrinkle, without any such thing, that she would be holy and blameless. That means that Hosea isn't going. I mean, do you think that Hosea had to go and tell everybody what Gomer did? I mean, everybody probably knew. He didn't have to go blabber it out. His job wasn't to blabber it out. His job was to present her holy and blameless. His job as a husband was to sanctify her, to redeem her, to help her be the wife that she should be. And that was about as most extreme example as you can have when you're talking about Hosea and Gomer there. If your wife hasn't went and played the harlot, what excuse do we have not to help to present them as husbands? What excuse do we have to not present them as holy and blameless without wrinkle? Or do we go and air the dirty laundry, so to speak? Is that our job, to air the dirty laundry, or is our job to present them holy and blameless? Is our job to present them without wrinkle or without spot in all her glory? So if we're looking as, just as wives are to be as subject to the husband as Christ is the church, the husband is to love the wives. It's more than just, I love my wife. But what is the purpose of that? Just as Christ is presenting his bride holy and blameless without spot or wrinkle, we as husbands are presenting our bride that way too, our wife that way. We don't tear them down. We're building them up, and when we're presenting them that way. And Hosea, you know, he didn't have to go. He definitely had a case for divorce against Gomer, but he went and purchased her. He bought her. He redeemed her. And it doesn't say much more information after that, but he is saying, you're going to stay with me now, and you're going to be my wife, and I'm going to be your husband. You're not going to seek after other men. It wasn't just this sad, distant relationship they had for the rest of their life. If we're looking at the comparison of, if they're compared to God and true Israel, that marriage is happy. So Hosea and Gomer's, what he is doing there is to present that, and it's going to be, it doesn't mean they didn't have struggles still, but his job was to present her and help her overcome that. His job wasn't to, I mean, he had every excuse to say, well, why does she need me? Let her pursue everybody else. That wasn't his job. His job was to present her and help her with that, just as Christ does for the church. And if the question that we have, do we seek to present our wives just as Christ did the church? And we can ask the question to the wives, hey, do you seek to be submissive to me as the church is to Christ? But as husbands, do we seek to be to help our wives as Christ does the church? And it's a lot harder than just saying, oh yeah, we're supposed to love our love our wives. And we're not going to finish everything here in chapter 5, because we're going to go and talk a little bit more dually next time, both husbands and wives, and we're going to talk probably about selfishness versus selflessness, and talk about sacrifice versus getting everything for me. But as husbands, we have to ask the question, are we being as Christ is to the church, to our spouse? Or are we looking for excuses? If Hosea was a type of Christ, the redeeming Gomer, he had a lot of excuses he probably could have used, but are we going to look past that? And I understand that there's obviously the examples where, I mean, like in life, that you have the Gomers that don't return, okay? And I'm not saying that there's, I mean, those are different situations, but as a whole, as husbands, we have to start that off. That starts with us at the beginning, like we talked in 1 Peter and in Colossians 3, not being embittered against our wives, not have it letting pride there, having spousal care, if you will, so that we don't have the pride and the jealousy and the bitterness, so that we do our part to help her be the wife that she is to be, not only for God and be the mother she's supposed to be, but also the wife that she can be for us. It's on our responsibility to help her with that. And we can look for excuses of why we don't need to do that or why she shouldn't. It's all her fault. And the same thing, you can do the same thing with the wives, the other way around. It's all his fault or whatever. But how are we, as husbands, how are we responsible? We have to ask that question. I guess I shouldn't say we are responsible. What are we doing about it? Like, are we helping our wife? Are we doing that for her? Does anybody have any comments?
I just like the comparison with this versus Ruth and Boaz. Mm-hmm. Because really, mm-hmm. Ruth and Boaz, they were both kind of filling those roles as they should have.
Right.
So it made it look easy. Mm-hmm. And in this case, like you said, it's about the most extreme mm-hmm. opposite as it could be.
Right.
But in the end, he still redeemed her when she wasn't worth redeeming.
Mm-hmm.
With the comparison of Christ, with us, with the church. There's lots of reasons that he could have casted her away and nobody would argue with him.
Right.
So, but then I think on the other side, her seeing that through all of that, he was still willing to redeem her, that probably said a lot to her too. Mm-hmm. So like you were saying, I can envision their relationship being more positive mm-hmm. from that point on too as well.
Yeah.
So it's a good contrast there of how those roles really are important.
Right. Any other comments or? You got something, Kyle? Okay, we'll stop here in verse 29, and we'll pick up next week then. So.